What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool Zone Media.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the show. It's me, James, today, and I'm joined by Dr. Mao Ghazani, who's an activist and scholar with 35 years of experience advocating against genocide and for freedom in Burma, and one of the founding members of the anarchist activist platform Forces of Renewal Southeast Asia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ghazani.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. So, and also, I should mention Nobel Peace Prize nominee as yesterday or the day before. So congratulations on that also.
Yeah, thanks so much. It happened in January before the deadline. And so, but I just released the announcement, for the Burmese New Year, you know, occasion, because, the country has been torn apart by, armed revolutions, genocide, the racism, anti-Muslim violence, and so thought like this may be a tiny sliver of positive thing. And so if activists want to have, some sustenance for their grassroots revolution, here's somebody who has been grassroots for 35 years. So that's why I released it. But that's, secondary anyway.
Yeah, I know. It's if it can get the world to look at what's happening and pay attention, then I think it's a good thing. So one thing I wanted to ask you about today to start off with is something that when I talk to people in the US and the UK about the revolution and the coup in Myanmar, the context of like ultra-nationalist Buddhism is one that is very hard, I think, for people who don't have a great understanding of how that works to understand. So I was wondering if we could start off with you explaining like this long and painful history of like ultra-nationalist Buddhism in Myanmar and how it's empowered the genocide of Muslim people and also the junta today.
Well, when we talk about, ultra-nationalism or various strands of nationalism, I think we need to periodize or put in different historical periods, because the term nationalism was a progressive emancipatory ideological umbrella when the local society of primarily Buddhist and also other people, but the majority political systems were built on the foundation of Buddhism in Burma, like different kingdoms. But when we were under the British for 124 years, the internally warring Buddhist kingdoms, like Rakhine and Mon and Burmese and Shan, they're all like Buddhist kingdoms, and they formed this oppositional ideological identity as, you know, nationalist Buddhists that would confront the alien colonial British rule. So in that sense, nationalism was not a bad thing at all, because it was, you know, primarily for emancipatory struggle.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, then fast forward post-colonial independence period, 1948 onward, right? Yeah. When the British rule was removed at the end of the Second World War, 3 years after, the oppositional Buddhist nationalist, you know, umbrella identity collapsed, right? So Rakhines want to foreground their ethnic city, given that the main oppositional commonality, colonialism was no more. And so that's when the ethnicity was re-injected, you know, into the ideological formation. And and interestingly, as you would know as well, the end of the Second World War was followed by the Cold War, right? And on the one hand, like, you've got, you know, godless, communist, atheistic Russia, Soviet Union, and then China. And then on the other hand, you know, essentially Christian West, you know, or at least allegedly Christian West. And in that context, the ultranationalism was essentially encouraged by the United States and allies. You know, like, this is nothing new. If you look at the rise of, like, a socialist governments across the Middle East, primarily Muslim Middle East, you would find, like, the rise of Muslim Brotherhood and, what we call today fundamentalist Islamists, right? But, the Buddhist with the ethnocentric orientation were encouraged, you know, by the United States through grants and aid.
Yeah.
But the same way, like, you know, the rise of, fundamentalist Islam was encouraged or midwifed with the U.S. money. Yeah. Because this is important, because through the eyes of the Cold War strategists, the only way that egalitarian leftist ideologies could be confronted was through the faith-based ideology. I'm not saying that the Burmese nationalists and ultra-nationalists were not responsible for their own growth, but I also, what I'm saying is, like, there was a larger global context in which this monster was hatched.
Yes.
But even, you know, like, going back to the 1930s after the Wall Street collapse, you know, then, like, you know, the deep recession pervaded across the world, and colonial economies like Burma, with massive agricultural export economy, the British found it expedient to basically turn to a religious divide and rule.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, the Burmese Buddhist laboring classes were pitted against the Indian laboring classes of different religions. But that was more like the Buddhist nationalist, ethno-nationalist versus, you know, like, what we would call today migrant laborers from India, you know, yeah, under the, because we were part of British Empire. After the British left, the Muslims began to be scapegoated. Yeah. And finally, I think, like, we cannot understand, as you know very well, the nationalism or ultra-nationalism without some kind of political organization. And that organization is what we call Burmese political state, whether it's controlled by the civilian elected politicians or the military junta, or military as an organization, political states always there, whether it's, you know, fascism in Nazi Germany or Italy or Japan, or like, you know, the genocidal Myanmar about 15 years ago. State was the engine, actually. It's not the people that were generating this toxic ideology. It was the state that was inventing, manipulating, and mobilizing towards their sinister ends.
Right, yeah. And it's the divide and rule strategy and the fall, I guess, to the falling back to this these kind of colonial methods of rule is something that I guess I want people to understand is still happening in Burma or Myanmar, right? We see the military, the junta doing it right now, right? Like attempting to foment inter-ethnic conflicts to prevent the formation of a popular front or a coalition against their rule, right?
Yes, I think the one observation I want to make is that, you know, independence from Britain, restoration of, say, like, you know, modern form of sovereignty to Burmese people was not a clean break from the colonial past, because the state in Burma, as it exists or it has existed over the last 70 plus years, remains a colonial state. It was an instrument of economic exploitation or racialized or ethnicized administration, and all the security laws and, you know, ordinances and whatnot, they were formulated with the interest of the ruling colonial interests or power, like at the time British. And what what independence did was really transfer of this internally racialized entity we call state from the white man's hand to the brown man's hand, you know, the Burmese. So yeah. So when you the state wasn't actually finding it difficult to foment racial or inter, we don't use the term race here, like inter-ethnic conflict or inter-religious conflict. The state itself embodied this divide and rule outlook because it remains internally colonial. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So
yeah.
So I think that it isn't simply the policies of the, you know, XYZ regimes that have ruled Burma since independence, but the state itself is conducive to or, you know, supportive of this kind of inter-religious and inter-ethnic contest, because there are no principles of equality as ethnic or religious communities. Or there was no sense of, you know, horizontal or vertical fairness among the political class and the majoritarian agrarian communities. And so the state itself is problematic. Yeah. That's why, like, you know, the when Aung San Suu Kyi came to, you know, semi power, because the military still controlled or backseat drove her regime, she found it really difficult to maneuver because she was straitjacketed in this, you know, internally colonial shell. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so I think, of course, like, you know, it's correct. What the military is doing now, say in Rakhine State, where they committed genocide against Rohingya Muslims, you know, they drove out, you know, close to 800,000 Rohingyas of genocidally across the border to Bangladesh in 2017 and also 16. They are now arming and training and, you know, forcibly conscripting able-bodied young Rohingya men into their ranks and to fight the progressively militarily stronger Rakhine Buddhist Arakan army. That's just one area. But, the, you know, if you look at other regions, like Shanxi, for instance, there's an extremely complex ethnic contestations happening, right? So what like political scientists call like a horizontal violence is taking place. And so it's like there are multiple conflicts at work, you know, but the, of course, like the military is number one, you know, problem maker, but there are also lesser evil forms of like political and ethnic conflicts taking place.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, it's very much okay. Shanxi is, I think, particularly complicated and interesting. As we look at the situation now in the different, like both in the liberated areas or the areas without control of the like Naypyidaw state, they may still be controlled kind of in a sense by other kind of like pseudo states, I guess. Are you familiar with this? There's this argument. I think it's probably like articulated. I'm sure you are articulated like most notably by James C. Scott of like, and he looks at the example of Myanmar has been rightly criticized in some areas of like the mountains as an area where people can, I guess, choose to opt out of the state or to be like where the state is not completely consolidated, I guess, and never has been.
Yeah, I know Jim's work, you know, like the he divides people into valleys and, you know, mountains,
yeah.
You know. But what's interesting is like, you know, it's a lot more complex than this, you know, the dualistic understanding of like hill people versus plain people, because, you know, like even in the hills, there are, you know, highlands and there are plateaus and, you know, also I think like that, I find it more useful to look at this, not through geographic lens, but through the colonial lens. Because you've got the colonial state, because like, you know, Jim is essentially an anti-statist, but as a matter of value, yeah, I am with him, you know, because I'm bent on the anarchism as my value, you know, But analytically, I think given the fact that the colonial state continues to live on and continue to haunt the Burmese society, I think like the way I look at it is like, you know, center and periphery, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Irrespective of the altitude. I mean, at this point, like altitude's no longer really strategically important because, you know, we live in the age of drones and like, you know, MiG-29s and F-16s. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like my mountains are no longer cover. You see what I mean, right?
Yeah, yeah. The construct of the mountains as like non-state space or a place where you can go to choose to be non-state, I think like it's interesting to hear young Burma PDFs fighters now be like, oh, I chose to go to the mountains, even though it sits very much alongside that Canolian analysis that you had of like the wild people or like quote unquote savagery, right? Which or when I speak to Burma people who are like 21 now, who joined the PDFs at 18, 17 after the coup, they had all been very much indoctrinated with the idea of non-Burma people as quote savages or wild people who lived in the quote mountains or jungles. And like choosing to go there to escape the state, I think it's really interesting to hear like that analysis reproduced in their storytelling of their own lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it has been in the Burmese political psyche. You move away from the center and you are more autonomous and you are, you know, freer from the,
right,
you know, the reach of the center, right? Because we still have this center periphery mentality.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, culturally, yes, you're absolutely right. The way people in the center, like the group that I belong to, Burmese Buddhist majority, we look down on people that are on the periphery, right? The way people dress. I mean, it's also like, you know, the rural and urban divide as well.
Yeah.
You know, even like those who grew up in the non-majoritarian, you know, regions, you know, what I call that, the peripheries of the Burmese colonial state, when they settle in Rangoon or Mandalay or you know, major urban areas, they begin to dress, they begin to, I mean, they necessarily adapt to the Burmese way of life, the majority dominant, you know, customs and whatnot. And then, so I still stick with the, you know, this whole colonial relations, you
yeah.
know, the organizationally and psychologically. We have the vocabulary. If you want to oppose a central state or the central regime, we say we take refuge in the forest, right?
Yeah.
And we take refuge in the forest or under the tree against the scorching sun, or like pouring monsoon rain, right? Mm-hmm. Or the evil center, right? And so it's all built in. It's in the language. Even, you know, like organizing an armed revolt or going underground is described as taking refuge in the forest, the jungle, you know. And what's interesting, though, is like, you know, from the state's perspective, if you're taking refuge in the jungle, of course, like that's treasonous, and you know, that is an act of criminality.
Yeah.
But if you use that language, or if you do exactly the same thing, literally, physically, if you're a Buddhist monk, you know, you are considered holier than monks that continue to live in the city. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you go, you know, the forest monks versus like a city, town, or village monk, right? So this is quite a fascinating linguistic, you know, twist here. On one hand, like, you know, but from the revolutionary's perspective, if you are in the jungle, you grow certain aura around you. You are in the jungle, right? And you don't wear jeans, or you don't look like city people, but you're wearing, you know, like the fatigue, army fatigue, and you know, jungle, the paraphernalia. And as a revolutionary, that's like, you know, that's like Che Guevara time. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Revolutions start or organize around jungles. You know what I mean? Now, so it has nothing to do with altitude. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just, yeah, I like that periphery colonial model.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I wonder, like, I think people who listen to this will both be very much like amenable to anarchism and see the problems that state societies create, and also to the revolution in Myanmar and to the young people and then the not so young people who are fighting it. I wonder, like, how do we build a future for Myanmar that doesn't replicate this colonial core periphery model, that doesn't, the sine qua non of the state that's centered in Naypyidaw is like the, it's this use of violence to control and this colonial relationship, right? So how do we not replicate that in a post-revolution future?
Well, I think, you know, there's a danger in, what should I say, the romanticizing the mini states or sub-states, right?
Mm-hmm.
If establishing autonomous states does not confront the colonial nature of the state from which these mini states, you know, emerge as oppositional entities. In other words, whatever administrative structures that the current armed revolutionary organizations set up, they need to first make sure they don't replicate the internally colonial nature of the state that they have been fighting and to some degree of like success at this point in history, right? Because the coloniality is very much connected with the idea of pure ethnic identity. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
yeah,
and in this day and age, I mean, you know, whether you, I mean, you've been to Karen State and other places in Burma and, you know, in the Middle East, the Kurdistan, so, but they're always like, you know, the idea of a pure ethnic identity, right? Even if you're a revolutionary, but the truth is, you know, even small places, you will find Muslims and Hindus and Christians or people with different migratory histories and class background. You flatten them into a single ethnic identity, right?
Yeah.
Self-perception, we are a new Karen state or Karani state or Kachin state, right? Even Kachin, the label Kachin in the north, you know, they have about like the three or four major groups there, and some resent being referred to as Kachin, but they go along because they are against the more evil central Burmese Buddhist state, right?
Right.
So that's why when I explained to you, you know, at the outset of this the conversation, this like your Buddhist identities merge as an oppositional umbrella anti-colonial identity against the British when that common oppressors has gone home, and then we start fighting each other. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that, yeah.
So number one is like, you know, the is very, very important. These new entities do not define their political organizations along any idea of like, you know, blood and soil. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's very, very important. Otherwise, we replicate what we fought against, right? And secondly, I think no military organization should control administrations. But at the moment, you know, with the exception of the Korean National Union, most other ethnically organized armed resistance organizations in Burma, when they set up administrations, you know, administrators are guys who are, you know, like carrying like AK-47 or some other weapons. You see what I mean? Because like what they need to do is as soon as like they have secure ancestral region, what they need to do is they need to separate law and order maintenance from the defense. Yeah. And the reason we have gotten into this bloody mess is because the military did not separate law and order administration as a civilian function from the national defense. So the current progressively militarily successful ethnic resistance organizations have to demilitarize self-consciously and as a matter of policy their new administrations. So these two things, you know, move away from blood and soil idea of identity and demilitarized and civilianized the administration.
Yeah. Do you have hope? Like, I find when I talk to especially younger people in the PDF who are mostly Burma, like, maybe it's easier for them to see the obvious, like, colonial relationship and the way that these constructs have harmed them and prevented them from finding solidarity with people of other ethnic groups. That's something that, like, sometimes they will articulate to me, right? That, like, you know, we were told these people were bad and evil and savage, and they're not, and they're our allies in this fight against dictatorship. Do you think that that's replicated in the leadership of EROs? Like, that idea that this blood and soil nationalism has been, this blood and soil identity, I should say, is something that's like been problematic and divisive and will always be so? Or like, do you not see that replicated so much?
Well, there's still, you know, the old conservative orientations in these EROs with respect to two things, the acceptance of, you know, younger generations into policy making circles, right?
Yeah.
And then the other one is the half of the population of these ethnic communities have remained marginalized, and that is women. If you, you know, I mean, on one hand, it does make sense that, you know, men with guns and men with, like, you know, the 50 years of revolutionary experience are going to play a leading role. But these guys have to make a conscious effort in changing their own value system, which is, like, you know, bring in new generations with more progressive ideas into policy making circle, leadership circle, and bring in women. And, you know, I wish I know more about the Kurdish revolutionary organizations. My own very limited understanding is that, you know, gender equality, I mean, for the Islamophobic crowd, it might be quite shocking, but the Kurdish revolutionary organizations are, you know, much more gender equal.
Yeah.
Than, like, you know, white democratic societies.
Yeah, that's right. And I think their analysis, if I can sort of summarize, like, Apo's thought very, is that colonialism begins in the patriarchal family, and that the first colonized subject is the woman. And therefore, if we can't decolonize our familial and community relations, then we have little hope of decolonizing ourselves as a group or as a society. So their analysis rests in the same place as yours does. And I think that there's, I think, increased solidarity and communication between the Kurdish freedom movement and the resistance movements in Myanmar, which I hope can only do good for that, like, especially with regard to gender relations. It was interesting to see the Kareni, KNDF Battalion 5, issued a statement which said that, like, they had a long way to go in terms of gender relations, and they looked to the Kurdish model of example of where they can get to, which at least it gives me hope that these things can get better.
Yeah, I mean, KNDF is a remarkable, organization, Karen National Defense Organization, right? Kareni. I mean, they are led by very progressive, sort of, like, you know, semi-anarchist type young people.
Yeah.
You know, the ethnicity and gender discrimination are self-consciously avoided and discouraged. Yeah, so yes. Basically, I think we cannot have a successful revolutionary movement, you know, just by trying to, you know, to take power from the center. You know, there has to be, you know, it's an armed rebellion is different from a revolutionary movement. Revolutionary movement involves a shifting fundamentally the non-progressive values and outlooks, right? That is what something that needs to happen, and that in my view is a deeply, you know, intellectual, psychological process. But I think like that is happening, you know, and so that ideological progressive shift is going to hit the ceiling at some point, because you've got old men in decision making positions who haven't bought in entirely the need to shift their value system. And then partially it's not simply ideological, it's also self-interest. when you're the boss for 25 years, you know, you're a little like autocratic tyrant, you know what I mean?
Right,
in your
yeah.
own little organization. So shifting the you know, giving women and younger generation spaces mean, you know, you shutting up 50% of the time and letting the other, you know, people speak 50%. You know, like there are no more like monologue for 1 hour. You see what I mean?
Even
like, you know, the air time, you have less air time. That's like your less, that's your self-interest, your air time, you know, let alone economic and other interests. This is just like talking in a meeting. You see what I mean? I've been through like some of the meetings and stuff. And so, you know, like guys think that only they have important things to say, and you know, especially military matters or big items. And, okay, like women talk about welfare of children and you know, widows kind of shit.
Yeah, yeah, this very sort of still like separate spheres, gender model. That I know. Yeah, I have hope for the young generation, but I remember one of the guys I met. He told me that, like, he said, like, 3 years ago, I had some gender problems, and I didn't understand what he meant. And he was like, I thought that women couldn't do things that men could do, and now I realize I was wrong. And like, they were telling me that the police wouldn't. There was a taboo to walk underneath a woman's lingerie.
Garment. Like,
yes, yeah. So they hung them around their protest camps when they were in Yangon fighting the police, and then the police wouldn't come in. So they were like, "Oh, this is when I realized that sexism hurts everyone." So I think it's, yeah, I have hope for that generation. I think it's been one of the things that has given me so much hope for the world in general, as I've been covering the revolution in Myanmar, is to see people reconstruct and change their identities in a progressive and inclusive way. And people, you know, people in this country and in the UK as well are so stuck in their sort of regressive identities. And to see young people there acknowledge that sexism, homophobia, these racist and interethnic like hierarchies are damaging everyone, it's given me a great deal of hope for the future.
Yeah, I share your optimism, and part of it is, you know, the progressives or people or younger people or like older people with progressive outlooks. I mean, everything is constructed, you know, like if you change the material situation in terms of, you know, who's making decisions or the, you know, under what conditions decisions are made. I think like people are able to shift their thinking. You see what I mean? And so I think like but definitely like political leadership is very important. You know what I mean? I don't believe in this like a vanguardist idea of like a group of men, guiding the herd, right? But at the same time, I think like these older men should meet the younger generations halfway. Yeah. And I'm not saying like, okay, all right, you know, like, don't trust anyone above 40 because I'm 60 and so I still want to be trusted. Right. And so, but yeah, I mean, like, I'm 60 and I can take shit from 18 year old junior friend or colleague who tell me you're full of shit. And here's the reason. I listen, right? So I assume like other people my age, my generation, would be able to do the adjustment, right? And especially like, for the better. And I think that there are really articulate young people and women,
yes,
whose voices need to come to the fore. Like, you know, like people. The people, I mean, like, we don't live in isolation anymore. Like, in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, Burma was very isolated. And so, you know, and so the ideological currents did not reach within the Burmese society. So the type of religion, religions, I mean, Christianity, the type of Christian practices, outlook, whatnot, remain like extremely conservative compared with like, you know, even like a conservative, like Christian country, like USA. Right.
Yeah.
But now like, you know, with, we live in the social media internet age. And so, you know, young people, you know, use the term like intersectionality. You see what I
yes.
mean?
Yeah.
They start to see like race, class, gender, and other issues, you know, like intersecting and producing or reproducing or ending like different forms of, you know, repression and, you know, exploitation and whatnot. We still have a very, very long way to go. We can't shift, but that's not to say that, you know, we should feel like discouraged, you know.
Right.
But we won't see instant changes now.
No, yeah, but I think over time, yeah, I have a great deal of optimism for the future of Myanmar. Dr. Zani, it's been really great talking. Where can people, especially people who are interested in your work and in the future of Myanmar, how can they follow along with your work and with these struggles to like, create a more equal and just and democratic in the non-state sense, Burma?
I use social media, especially like, you know, Facebook a lot. And I began like consciously writing in Burmese language because I don't need to inform the world because the world know the shit that's going on in Burma. I think the my Facebook's okay. But if people read like English or even like, you know, other languages, you know, our own mother tongue, the Forces of Renewal Southeast Asia, 4C.co, it's a good platform where we encourage and actually we seek out, you know, very radical ideas in multiple languages, Burmese or Chin or Karani or whatever language they want to use. We don't censor anyone. They can say anything as long as they're not advocating fascism or violence or like, you know, the things like that. And so, yeah, I encourage to take a glance at our, you know, Southeast Asia network of like anarchistic activists and scholars.
Yeah, it's a great website. I'll include a link to it in the description. Thank you so much for your time this evening. We really appreciate it.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.